The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So it's Mother's Day, if you hadn't noticed. And in honor of mothers who are usually generous, not always, I thought I would talk on the topic of generosity. And specifically, as I said earlier, the generosity of letting go. So I wanted to start with a story. This is a story from StoryCorps. Are people familiar with StoryCorps? Yeah. So StoryCorps, I think it's NPR's. Yeah. So they go around and they collect these amazing stories of people. And if you're ever in need of inspiration, then just go to StoryCorps. And these are, the Buddha talked about the importance of being around people who are practicing and teaching the Dharma in order to counteract doubt. And all of these people in StoryCorps are practicing the Dharma, as far as I'm concerned. Another one of my favorite sites is the Forgiveness Project, if you've ever looked at that. So this is a story from StoryCorps, and it's called There's Always Room at His Table. Maybe you've heard this. It's about a man named Scott McCauley. And this is Scott McCauley. So you know what he looks like. Actually, there's a picture of him where he's holding a, what do you call those things, oven mitt. And that wasn't captured in this picture, unfortunately. And you'll see in a minute why that's important. So this is Scott McCauley. In September of 1985, when I was 24, my folks decided to get divorced. I was taught that to be a good son, I needed to be supportive and loving to each parent and to my siblings. But nobody was talking to anybody. If you were nice to one parent, the other one would get mad at you. So when October came, I thought, what's going to happen at Thanksgiving? And I just did not like the thought of being home alone or anywhere alone at Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is not about gifts or fireworks or hoopla. It's a meal around a table where you give thanks for the blessings you have, and you really can't do that by yourself and have much fun. I decided to put an ad in the local paper. If people thought they would find themselves alone, they could give me a call, and I would make a Thanksgiving dinner. The first year, a few people came, and they had a good time. I was nervous about making a mess out of the food and disappointing people, but the food was okay, and I didn't burn anything. I've held the dinner every year since. Last Thanksgiving, 84 people showed up. Sometimes they're new to town. Sometimes they're recently divorced or widowed. I've had people who were new to the country and didn't speak any English, but they enjoyed my Thanksgiving dinner. I've had poor people, people who come from AA, old people. Also not counted within that number, I always feed the police. The firefighters and EMTs are in buildings with kitchens and can have their own Thanksgiving dinner among themselves. But the police officers are in their cars, driving around town on call. 2 years ago, a woman with Parkinson's disease came, and she was not good on her feet. She had been in a nursing home for 7 years and had never been out. Somebody told her about the dinner, and she hired an ambulance to bring her at $200 plus mileage. It's probably a lot more than that now. She had a great time. And she cried when the ambulance returned to get her. She didn't want to go home. Most of the people who come don't know who I am. They know that there's some skinny guy in the kitchen, but they don't know my name. I think the theme of my life and everything I do could be summed up with the name of an old hymn called Brighten the Corner Where You Are. I hope my legacy will be that I came into the world, I brightened the corner, and then I quietly left the world unnoticed. So if that isn't the Dharma, I don't know what is. So Scott McCauley isn't technically a mother. At least I don't think he's a mother. But he might be an honorary mother. And his selflessness, I think, is what's often associated with mothers. And I think that actually that's what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about dana or generosity. He was talking about that kind of selflessness. So I'm going to try to define terms here because I imagine everybody here knows these kind of Buddhist lingo, but maybe they don't. So when I use kind of a Buddhist term or refer to somebody, I'll try to tell you what it is. So dana is the Pali word. Pali was the word that the language that the Buddha's teachings were written down in. It's not the language he actually spoke. It's one of the what are called the paramis, or the qualities of the awakened mind, the mind of a Buddha. And these were the things that the Buddha was perfecting over his many, many lifetimes before he became the Buddha. So if you know the Jataka tales are these lovely little folk tales about the Buddha who is embodied in different forms, mostly animal forms. And each of those tales is about the Buddha perfecting one of these qualities, these spiritual qualities. So in this tradition, the Theravadin tradition, there are 10 such qualities, 10 paramis. There are different numbers in other traditions, and I don't know why, so don't ask that. But they're all based on the welfare for other beings. And so generosity is the first of the paramis, and the other 9 are virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. So we can make a lifetime out of practicing any of those, I think. And actually, people in Asia, I'm told, don't get why people in the West spend so much focus on meditation, because in many Buddhist countries like Thailand or Burma, what they're focused on is the paramis. That's what they're practicing. So generosity is very, very important in terms of their own practice. And meditation takes a second seat. Meditation is something you do after you've perfected these other things. So they kind of think we've got it backwards here in this country. So generosity, it said it's listed first because it's a quality that's available to all of us. So we're just ordinary people can be generous, or I think what the Buddha would call us, the uninstructed worldlings. And it's also considered to be the easiest of the paramis to practice and the foundation of a spiritual life. And I don't think that has to be a Buddhist life. It could be any spiritual life. Generosity is critical. So one of the senior monks in Ajahn Chah's lineage, so Ajahn Chah, if you're not familiar with him, he was a forest, in the forest tradition in Thailand, very revered teacher of the last century. So he remarked that the Buddha talked about generosity first because if someone didn't understand the value of basic generosity, they weren't teachable. So even though we can think of generosity as being the most basic and perhaps the easiest of these spiritual perfections, it actually isn't as simple as it sounds, and maybe you already know this. So as anyone who's given anything away, we can be left with a very different experience depending on what our original intent was. So if you're a person who works in an organization and every Christmas they've got the annual drive and there's kind of all this pressure to be donating to whatever and there's kind of this team effort, and if you don't, you know, show up with your donation, then there's almost shame around that. That has a very different feel to it. I speak from personal experience. That has a very different feel to it than just spontaneously dropping money in the Salvation Army bucket or whatever. When we feel obligated, it's not the same thing. So the idea is that our generosity be attuned to our motivation, whatever it may be, and that we learn from our direct experience. That is all of the path, right? It's all about what we personally are learning. It's not what I'm telling you or what somebody else is telling you or the Buddha is telling you, for that matter. It's about trying these things out and learning from our experience. So I'm going to pause for a minute, and that's one thing I'm going to do throughout this talk, because Dharma talks are so weird, right? We're trying to talk about something that's experiential, that really doesn't have words. So I want to just invite you for a minute to come back into your bodies. And just let all of the words that have been spoken go, and feel into the body and the breath. Connecting with what is present right now. Once heard somebody give a Dharma talk on why giving Dharma talks was so ridiculous. He did a pretty good job. And they say all Dharma talks are about the same thing. And, you know, you'll hear something 100 times, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, is that what they were talking about? So maybe you'll have that experience tonight. I don't know. So as a spiritual practice, dana, or the practice of generosity, is about learning from the giving and also from the holding back. To see for ourselves what feels best. To see all of the subtle attachments we have, the ways that we hold on, the ways that we think only of ourselves. And then to know also the release of letting go, when it is possible for us to let go. See if we're motivated by the wholesome desire to free our minds and work for the benefit of others, to get free from our conditioning. Or are we motivated by something perhaps a little less wholesome, like the desire for a recognition or the belief that we should be doing something? So in the Dana Sutta, so that's one, the Sutta on generosity, the suttas are the teachings of the Buddha, kind of like sermons, but not really. The Buddha describes 6 possible motivations that one might have for being generous, and he listed them in ascending order. So the first was giving to see one's own profit. The second was giving because one believes that giving is good. The third is giving because one understands that one is better off than others. That's one of my favorites. Giving because the other people one admires have given. Giving because it makes the mind serene and joyful. And finally, the highest motivation was giving because it is an ornament for the mind, a support for the mind. So by that he meant that it's the motivation to be free, a desire to support one's opening, one's awakening. And that motivation is the one that bears the greatest fruit. And it's also said that that is the most difficult and really only available to those who have fairly advanced practices, which made me feel better. So the next time we're moved to generosity, we might pause and check out what our motivation is before we give. Is our motivation aligned with our highest spiritual goal and likely to lead to our freedom, which I think would be Scott McCauley's case? He's pretty clear about what his motivation is. Or is it tinged with greed, anger, or delusion and likely to lead to suffering? So I'll give you a personal example of the latter. So several years ago, I was in India, and I went in this little shop, and there were these beautiful shawls in there. I still remember it. The walls were just lined with these beautiful things, and the shopkeeper brought them out, put them out, showed them all, and I picked out the one that I really liked, which had these little blue beads on it and fringe and all this stuff, and I kind of imagined my sitting and meditating with this thing, and I was very attached to it. So I brought it home, and I was with a friend, and I was wearing it, and the friend said, "Oh, that's really beautiful." And I took it off my shoulders, and I gave it to her, and I said, "Here, you know, take this." And I haven't seen that shawl since. And I think to myself, is she wearing it? Why did I give her that shawl? And it really taught me a lesson in suffering. You know, I still suffer over that shawl, because I wasn't at all clear. You know, I didn't pause. I didn't check in with my motivation. I was coming out of this place where, well, we should be willing to give away everything, right? Even these things that we're very attached, especially these things that we're very attached to. And so I need to give this to her. But I really wasn't giving it with a very clear, open heart. And had I paused, I might have realized that. And I also might have felt what it feels like to hold back. So I would have learned two things. And then maybe the next time I might have been a little better able to let go. Maybe not. So right now I'm thinking, what did she do with that shawl? So maybe you've had experiences like that yourself. I'm guessing at least somebody has. I gave this talk this morning in Northfield and I saw all these heads going like this. So when we can connect to our motivation and it feels like we are giving out of something that's clearer, then even the smallest act of generosity is worthwhile. So this is from the Anguttara Nikaya, or the numerical discourses of the Buddha. Even if a person throws the rinsings of a bowl or a cup into a village pool or pond, thinking, "May whatever animals live here feed on this," that would be a source of merit. So just the smallest things can have great merit. And every day we have the opportunity to be the recipient of that if we're really paying attention, or to be the giver of these small yet significant gifts. So I was just thinking the other day, I was going to hear Sherry Turkle. She spoke at the U, and I was walking down a hallway at night, and the only person in that hallway was a custodian. And I was all wrapped up in my own stories and thinking about my sister who's not very well, and my mood was not very light. And this custodian came out right in front of me and said, "Oh, you know, good evening." He said, "You know, may you be safe on your way," or something like that. That's what the recording actually on the garage says at the U. And every time I pay to get out of that garage, the recording says, "May you be safe on your way." It's like, wow. So this custodian came out and said this to me, and it was like, I felt so uplifted. I mean, I'm just uplifted telling this story. So that was a very small thing. I imagine he probably felt pretty good saying it, too. So we have so many opportunities like that, as you know. So we might think of generosity as mostly in terms of the benefits to the receiver, but it actually goes both ways. So this is the Buddha again. In this world, monks, there are three things of value for one who gives. What are these things? Before giving, the mind of the giver is happy. While giving, the mind of the giver is made peaceful. And after having given, the mind of the giver is uplifted. So I'm guessing that custodian, bless his heart, I'm hoping that his mind was uplifted. I think it was. He seemed like a pretty happy person. And this is from the Siha Sutta. One who is generous is dear and charming to people at large. Furthermore, good people, people of integrity, admire one who is generous. Furthermore, the fine reputation of one who is generous, a master of giving, is spread far and wide. Furthermore, when one who is generous approaches any assembly of people, noble warriors, Brahmins, householders, or contemplatives, he or she does so confidently and without embarrassment. Furthermore, at the breakup of the body after death, one who is generous reappears in a good destination, the heavenly world. So why wouldn't we want to be generous? And we can only think of Scott McCauley and his Thanksgiving feast to see the truth of this. So the Buddha talked about generosity as including the giving of three things. The first was material things. The second was fearlessness. And the third was the Dhamma. So in the Buddha's days, material things included external things, and those would have been food, drink, vehicles. Imagine giving your car away. Garlands, scents, unguents, bedding, dwellings, and lamps. These things, I guess, were important in his time. Or internal things, including limbs or organs. So if you haven't signed up to be an organ donor, you might reconsider. Fearlessness is the giving of protection to beings when they are frightened. And giving the Dhamma is providing instruction on the Dhamma with an undefiled mind. So let's take a moment again and drop the words. And connect once again with the body and with the breath and with the heart mind. And if there are ways that you need to extend yourself some generosity in this moment, whatever that may be, kind words spoken internally, or the touch of your hand, or adjusting your body, or whatever it is you need, then offering yourself generosity. So it being Mother's Day, a day when mothers have privileges, I'm going to exercise my privilege. I'm a mother. And I'm going to add one more thing to the Buddha's list. And that would be the gift of letting go of our children. Letting go of our expectations that they think or behave in a certain way. Letting go of our attachment to outcomes. Letting go of the desire to be appreciated. Letting go of, you fill in the blank, if there's something that I've missed. And so I'm talking about mothers, but this could be any relationship, really. It could be your relationship with your dearest friend or with a partner or with your parents. It could be Father's Day. These are just arbitrary terms. We're just talking about relationships in which there's a deep, deep attachment. So even though my own son is well into adulthood with a wonderful wife who's sitting in the back here tonight, this letting go is still a large part of my practice of generosity, and for me it's really where the rubber meets the road in terms of this parami. And I was driving to Northfield this morning because I was going to talk at the Northfield group, and I thought, oh, this is really strange, because 18 years ago, as I was driving to drop my son off at Carleton for his freshman year, that was the time that I realized that I needed a way to let go. And I thought, okay, those Buddhists, they talk about suffering. They must know something about this. And so it was really, that was the catalyst for my investigating the path. And so I went back home and signed up for a course, as did he actually at the same time at Carleton. And so we had that thing to share. So it's a practice that I'm still working on. And it's so interesting that I'm talking about it on Mother's Day. So as I mentioned earlier, the practice of dana or generosity is learning from the giving and also from the holding back, and to see for ourselves what those feel like, to see our attachments that hold us back, and to think of ourselves and to know the release of letting go. And in my experience and my opinion, this requires a great deal of courage and self-compassion, especially when it comes to letting go of our children or whomever we want to put in that slot that I talked about. In fact, it feels like it has this practice as elements not only of generosity, but of all the other paramis as well. Virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and especially equanimity. All of these things are involved. So I had the opportunity to really experience this myself in a very visceral way on a recent 2-month retreat at Spirit Rock, where my son was teaching the last 2 weeks. And I had been sitting there for 6 weeks in silence, and I was pretty deep into it. And he showed up. He showed up with his wife as well. And the minute he walked into the room, I just felt this enormous, visceral longing for connection. It was all I could do to just about knock me off my seat. And I don't think I would have felt it to that degree had I not been silent for that amount of time. And I also was so aware of the fact that I wanted to be publicly acknowledged as his mother. I'm smiling as I say this because it's so embarrassing. But I wanted him to sit up there and say, "And my mom, she's sitting there in the back, and you know, she's the reason I'm here." You know, all this. It was just, I wanted so much to have that happen. And I felt about this high. And he's about this high. And you know, he didn't look at me or say a word to me for 14 days. And so I just got to sit with the not so subtle attachments. And it was an amazing, amazing experience of humility, of letting go, of having to sit, makes me want to cry, of having to sit with the pain of that longing, and the knowledge that this was not where freedom lay, that I needed to just be with it and experience it, and that if I could do that, that I would come through to the other side. It wasn't that I wasn't going to feel the pain again, but somehow it was changing my relationship to it. And I think that's what I realized when I was driving down to Northfield, because I thought, okay, how is this different 18 years later? And the difference is not that I don't feel those things anymore, because I do, but I am relating to it in a very, very different way. I'm able to turn to it, to look at it, to offer myself kindness, and through that also to connect to the whole world of everybody else who's in the same boat. You don't have to be a mother, of course, to experience this. And so it breaks out of that isolation of me, and into the wider world of humanity. So this is what the Buddha was talking about when he said that all of his teachings could be summarized as Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. Or as a teacher of mine at the Spirit Rock Retreat said, in this practice we are giving up back to nature that which is nature's. We are giving back to nature that which is nature's. So I'm going to read a poem that speaks to this by Cahil Gibran called On Children. Maybe you know it. And actually, after I spoke this morning, somebody in the group said, you know, Sweet Honey in the Rock recorded that. Maybe you heard this. So I rushed home, and I actually figured out how to download the thing onto a CD, and then I came here, and there's no CD player. But I recommend you listen to it. It's so lovely. So these are the words. Your children are not your children. And you could substitute your partner is not your partner or whatever you want to say. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you, for life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children are living arrows, as living arrows are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might, that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness, for even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he loves also the bow that is stable. So, as mothers, as fathers, as partners, as whatever role you are playing, we are called to give back to nature, to life, that which was never really ours in the first place, this person that is so beloved to us. And we're called to be grateful for the brief moment in time when we shared a life. And to understand that this too will end and never be repeated. And this goes both ways, of course, because we will all also be in the position, if we haven't already been in it, of letting go of our own parents. So we walk this line between knowing that we have to let go and feeling the pull, the longing, the deep connection to another being. This is a part of being human. This is the territory of generosity. This is the territory of the quivering heart, of staying connected to our deepest intention for freedom, and especially the freedom of those we love. So Ajahn Amaro describes it this way. Ajahn Amaro was a disciple of Ajahn Sumedho, who was a disciple of Ajahn Chah. There's a mysterious twinning here of both the realization of ultimate truth and the recognition of the unique quality of that personal connection on the material plane. Perhaps it is natural and perfectly appropriate to accord this being, whether it's your child, partner, mother, whoever it is, with whom we have a unique relationship, a special position among all the dimensions of life that we experience. Actually, he says this at the end of a description where he's talking about Ajahn Chah and Sri Ramana Maharishi, whose mothers became their disciples. Actually, the Buddha's stepmother became his disciple as well. And at their deaths, they both accorded them praise. And Ajahn Chah actually ordained like 200 people at his mother's funeral as a sign of respect to her. And when she was cremated, he built his temple on the place where he buried her ashes. So it's not that we, again, that we're disregarding these connections or we're thinking we have to give up these attachments, but we're really feeling into this deep longing that we have to keep these attachments, which are sometimes obscures the freedom of the heart. So I think I'll end there. Someone asked me this morning, how long are you going to speak? I said, I'll speak until I have nothing more to say. And I don't have anything more to say. So I think I'll end there. And before we take questions and answers, if there are any, I would like to just dedicate the merit. So dedicate the merit of our being here together. So the merit, may the merit of our practice, of our being here together, of our desire to wake up, may the merit of this practice be for the benefit of all beings who inhabit these exquisitely sensitive human bodies. All beings who love and have to let go. May all beings be free. May all beings find peace. So, questions, comments, reflections?
Okay, so I'm Robin. I think I've been trying to practice letting go. Most often just with relationships that I have and understanding that relationships in general are fluid, and a person can have meaningful impact in your life for an hour or 2 months or 3 years and can exit, and you don't have to be upset at them exiting at a place that they needed to or the time that they needed to. But I think most recently something that's come up with my practice and kind of what you touched on too is just underestimating myself. And I think a lot of folks from what I've talked to, we underestimate ourselves of being able to sit with the grief, with the frustration, with the sadness of having to let go of an attachment or a connection to somebody who we value. And it feels as if it's overwhelming and it's going to take us in the wave. And I guess also trying to be conscious of when it's how to use my practice to tend to my heart and know that at this moment, it's not the most wholesome thing for me to do to sit 30 minutes with this grief and when it's appropriate for me to work through that and not avert the entire process and just try to keep just try to do what I can to make that attachment stay as long as it can and hope for the best, and it'll fizzle out at some point, and that's not how life goes. So just learning to not underestimate myself in the process and letting that transition of a relationship flow organically or exit organically. And yeah, still working on that. But at some point, I would like to be there consistently. I've had really good enlightened moments like, yeah, I got it. And then other moments when I'm not getting it. So it's an ongoing practice. So
yeah. Thank you. You. And the really great thing is we get to keep starting over again. Yeah. But I really like what you say about discerning what you need. And, you know, it requires what I think of as fierce self-compassion. And that doesn't always mean staying in the fire. Sometimes we need to find other ways. Yeah. Thank you.
I enjoy public speaking, so. Spent the day with my mother today, and for the longest time, I have been frustrated with myself for my frustration with her. Moms can be hard. So, anyways, today I was really, really pleased because I got to spend the day with my mom, and I wanted to spend the day with my mom, and I cried after she left because it felt so good. Mm. You know, I felt like my mom would do anything, and I've always felt so, like, entitled, and it just always felt icky, you know, and, like, today I didn't feel that way, so it was, like, so cool. I kind of feel like I'm growing up a little bit. So it was, I wanted to share that.
Thank you.
It reminded me of generosity. I guess like when I imagine what I think she wants is just to spend time with me and not have me pick at things that aren't even wrong with her. You know? So it felt really good.
Yeah. So savor the feeling of that. You know, the Buddha talks about how we need to really stay with these feelings of wholesomeness and really enjoy those so that the likelihood of it showing up again is increased. So, yeah, thank you.
My name is Ben, and curious if you have some thoughts on those moments that I've certainly had where I feel like I'm about to give something, but I don't feel comfortable with it. And I know if I give it, I feel like I've given too much. And if I don't give, then I feel guilty because I didn't do it.
What have you done so far?
Those two things. Yeah.
So you sat with it? Is that what you're saying? That you just stayed with the ambiguity?
And then I feel like I gave too much, or I don't, and then I feel guilty.
Okay. I would, you know, again, we're learning from our own experience. So to really drop into what that feels like, there's not a right or a wrong here. It's just about noticing, right, what's arising. And noticing, is that making us happy or unhappy? Is it making others happy or unhappy? So that's all you have to do. That's all you have to do is be aware. Sounds like you are aware. And it'll sort itself out. That's how you learn. Yeah.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.